This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, an absolute corker at the Etihad. Spurs turned Spursy and then back again against Manchester City. We'll try and discuss the game and not focus too much on whistle-happy Simon Hooper. Liverpool bring the vibes to Anfield to break Fulham hearts. Are they the biggest challengers to City's inevitable title? Or is it Arsenal who kept the jeopardy going against Monday Night Football's Gary O'Neill's Wolves? Manchester United are back in crisis mode. What do you expect when you have to travel by automobile rather than plane? Tis the season, we have our first sacking. Paul Heckingbottom is gone after Ollie McBurney fails to keep his elbows to himself. Will perennial man under pressure Steve Cooper follow after Forrest got dished at the City Ground? Elsewhere, how far into the bag do England have the Euros? A favourable group and a tasty one for Scotland as the draw is made. Team GB are still in with a shout of making it to the Olympics. Bizarrely, only a home nation stands in their way. We'll discuss all of that, plus we'll have your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. So for the more observant among you, you might have noticed I'm not Max Rushton. Barry Glendening is also absent today. They've both gone on a pilgrimage of self-reflection following recent revelations about Max's Torlington woes. His Sydney hotel room anecdote triggered Barry's Munich moment. They will return transformed, better, more self-aware. Lessons will be learned. A root and branch review will be carried out. And who knows, maybe even Sony will produce a documentary on their journey. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, good morning.
Morning, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Lucy Ward, hello.
Hi, Rob.
And Barney Ronay, good morning.
Hi, Robin. No, I think it's great that you've taken over from Max. He had a good run. all quite good things come to an end. And while we should remember him, we should also just move on very quickly and never talk about him again.
Okay, yeah, that's usually how these things work, isn't it? This is very much interim, though. I'm very proud to be having the interim on the graphic, yeah. So.
Oh, I thought this was it. I can't wait. It's going to be great to get Max. Great to have you here, but really looking forward to getting Max back.
But not Barry.
Is this the airing of grievances bit there in the window, right at the top?
Now that's every week here.
Yeah. Well, let's start then. It's been a fantastic weekend of football, starting, well, with last night, Manchester City against Spurs. Barney, you were there, mate.
Yeah, I was there, and it was a really good game. I mean, I'm sure it was good on telly as well, but I've kind of been resistant to the kind of what you might call the Ange nonces, you know, the kind of, mate, he's so emotionally intelligent, you know, he's just a bloke, you know. And you kind of, because everyone's been so gushing, you kind of want it to fail. I don't want it to fail, but there's some part of you that quite would enjoy that narrative arc. But I just thought that was actually really good yesterday. And he did change. He played the four fullbacks in defence and not many defensive players. And you thought, oh, God, this is going to be a disaster. You know, they're going to play this high line against Doku and Haaland and they're going to lose 7-1. But he did. They adapted and they actually defended really deep at times, ridiculously deep. But you saw the difference between a centre-half and a fullback trying to decide where should your starting position be. Like Foden's goal was basically on the goal line where he scored it from. But they really stuck with it, and I thought it was really impressive to score two equalisers. I thought the attacking was really coherent, and it was very logical to play like that. It's like, what strength do we have? We have really quick attackers against some quite not that quick City defenders. That's our strength. That's our only chance. So it would be illogical not to play to that. And it wasn't sort of naive, gung-ho attacking. It was just a really sensible thing to do, because if you just try and, you know, play out deep block with VAR, you know, VAR has meant deep defending is just a much, much harder to do, because in the end, you're going to give something away. So I just thought it was really smart. And for the first time, I actually thought, good on you, Henge. He's just a great bloke with great vibes and all that. I mean, I'm normally very anti-Australian, but and Australianism generally, but it was, I thought it was really impressive and, you know, good on him.
Did we lose a bit of respect for him, though, Jonathan? Especially in that, you know, after half-time, he takes off Hill, he brings on Højbjerg, the coward. He said he was going to stick to his principles.
I mean, if his principals were playing Brian Hill at all moments, then I think you'd have to question that. you can change your, you can make tweaks without sort of it being a wholesale recantation of the Ange philosophy. I mean, I think what Barney says is right, that there was no point playing Eric Dier as you know, the only sort of senior fit centre back in the squad, because Haaland is better than Dier at everything. So you can't play high line because Dier's slow on the turn. Haaland would probably beat him in the air more often than not. So at least by playing fullbacks there, although you know, it does create certain issues, you've got that mobility. You can play the high line, and if a ball gets played over the top, they have got the pace to get back. But I think almost the more significant thing was the fact he kept the three forwards up at all times, which then forced Guardiola into the change, and Akanji had to drop deeper. By doing that, yeah, Alvarez's role has been a slight sort of underlying issue for City this season, that they have to find another midfielder from somewhere, which is why Akanji, or more ideally Stones, would step up into midfield. And that midfield was vacant. I think Spurs found it relatively easy to play out. So the tactical side of it, you know, I thought was really interesting. And I don't know, I mean, maybe we're kind of reading too much into this. I mean, City did hit the woodwork twice. Haaland did miss that great chance. It was, the XG was what, 2.6 to 0.5, I think. So City could have won it quite easily. But it sort of feels quite significant. They've now drawn the last three league games, let in two against Leipzig. Defensively, they're clearly not as good this season. Yeah, they're letting in, I think, 1.14 goals per game in the league, as opposed to sort of a 0.85 standard over the last three seasons. There are defensive issues there. And of course, Rodri now suspended for Villa on Wednesday. Villa, who scored more goals at home than anybody apart from Bayern Munich across Europe this season, suddenly that game looks really exciting.
It does. Doku also picked up a knock, and so Rodri's out, and also Jack Grealish is going to be suspended for that one too. I got a bit ahead of myself. It was a brilliant game. So Son scored twice, first in the right end after 6 minutes, a really good breakaway, then an own goal. Phil Foden then scored to make it 2-1. But after the break, Lucy, I don't know if you were watching on Sky, but Gary Neville said at 2-1, City are looking sloppy and complacent. I'm not sure if you agreed with him, but it kind of came to pass a little bit after that.
Yeah, I think it did. I think that they rely on sort of full control of particularly central areas, City, because obviously, you know, they attack quite a lot. But I think they've lost that. I think because of Stones not being there, because losing Gundogan, they haven't really got a creative player in there. And I think the ones that they've signed to replace have not particularly got themselves going yet. But a couple of points from that. Grealish definitely didn't fancy a Villa Park return, because when you get a yellow card for kicking the ball away, you know you're going on and getting a yellow card and missing going back to Villa. Definitely. That's certainly what I thought. And I wish I was a Spurs fan, to be honest, because just going and now watching a team who do that. I mean, he sort of tweaked a little bit. He didn't really change what he did, obviously, just a little few tweaks with, you know, because of the injuries. But sitting back, really sitting back all the way through versus City is not guaranteed to work anyway. And it just tells the players, if you keep changing, that you don't really believe what you've been telling them since July. Postecoglou, it's not just about his players, it's about the training ground. It's about how people will support him, because he can connect with people. So I can imagine how good the Spurs training ground is simply because of the way that he is a, you know, a proper people person.
Well, Max isn't here, so we do need an Ange apologist. Just for balance, because I do work for the BBC, I watched back the live show from Brighton last week, and Johnny Liu described Ange Postecoglou as a pathetic Aussie PE teacher. Thoughts, anyone?
I think that says more about Johnny than it does anybody else.
Yeah, the strong words. And he also, yeah, came out on the pod and said that. So after that, as we mentioned, Manchester City a little bit sloppy. Lo Celso scored a great goal. And then, Barney, was Eve Bissouma sort of turning into traffic for a fairly simple one for Jack Grealish after that. And then Kulusevski with the, well, what we loved that he flattened, absolutely flattened Ake by getting to that header.
I think it did it come off his shoulder. I mean, I thought it kind of was one of those ones that sort of head onto shoulder and sort of leaped in. But it was brilliant. I really enjoyed, I don't know if you saw, could see Richarlison's, I thought Richarlison had scored at first, because he went completely mental when it went in. And I think that was a big relief for him. But I was interested also by the stuff at the end. I mean, Haaland was really, really cross. I've never seen him so cross. The interaction with Lo Celso was actually quite funny because Lo Celso, I don't think, really understood what he was talking about. He just looked completely unbothered, and he's this really quite small guy next to Haaland. It was quite funny watching that happen. The referee, see, in the stadium, we thought at the time that it must have been offside. With the incident where the referee waved play on after a foul on Haaland, who then played a great through pass to Grealish, and you thought, okay, he's in here. And then he stopped play. And we thought, well, that must be because it's offside and there's no advantage. But that wasn't the case. He just changed his mind, the referee. And so it was a poor decision. But I think it's been slightly overdone since, because it was an opportunity. It was an opening. It wasn't he wasn't clear through on goal. There were three players running back with him. Something might have happened. Who knows? Grealish isn't Doku. He's not going to run away from those players. And I think with Haaland, there was some frustration, probably because he's a very good player, with his own performance, because he did miss two open goals. Yeah. He probably felt quite frustrated. He did make Grealish's goal with a really nice little bit of play, but he didn't have a very good game. There's times where you look at him and you think, well, they're basically playing not with 10 men, because his presence is a massive distraction for the defence, but it's like when one of those riderless horses wins the Grand National. There's this thing there that's not really doing anything but is visible, and the rest of his team do have to make up the fact that he's in many ways not a very good footballer, despite being arguably the Ballon d'Or winner. You know, he's very uneven in what he does, although having said that, the movement and the run and the pass for Grealish's goal were really good, and I think he's getting better at that. But I think he was really frustrated with himself, and I don't think we should be distracted by that one refereeing decision. City could have won that game quite easily if they'd taken the chances, and they were probably frustrated by that. And to be fair, in his press conference, Pep Guardiola didn't really talk about it. He'd got it out of his system. He said, yeah, it was one of those things. We'll look at other things after that game, not the referee, which I thought was fair enough.
I think, well, he kind of had a little dig at Mikel Arteta, didn't he? Saying, well, I'm not going to do a Mikel Arteta comment. So, yeah, so he managed to get that in at least. On X, Haaland wrote WTF above a clip of that incident. He'll probably get charged by the FA for that. On City, though, so 10 goals they conceded in the last four games. Barney, do you feel like that, you know, usually Pep Guardiola kind of figures these things out. Like last season, he did the sort of putting John Stones into midfield. Obviously, he's a big absence. Are we still expecting them to figure this out and run away with it maybe in the new year?
Well, they often have a slow autumn, don't they? And part of that is related to why they succeed, because Guardiola doesn't let the team stand still. You know, he changes all the time to keep himself ahead. And that takes time. Although I would say last year, I think they were helped by the break, you know, the World Cup. Haaland wasn't there. Guardiola worked with him a lot. And that was a pretty useful thing if you're re-gearing a team. They were really good after, about a month after the World Cup, they really started playing well. So I don't think they're finished. I mean, they still, if you looked at their bench, I claimed that every single player on their bench would have started for Spurs. Some people probably disagree, maybe the goalie. I think Oscar Bob would probably be in the Spurs team. And, you know, the rest of them are just really good players. So I don't think they're quite in crisis. I don't think we can have two simultaneous Manchester crises, can we? Maybe we can.
It'd be fun though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
To Anfield then, Liverpool 4, Fulham 3. Some incredible goals in this game, particularly Alexis McAllister. I very much enjoyed Marco Silva afterwards saying that he wouldn't do that again if he tried for 2 hours, which would have been, I love that, if Silva had kind of led him out to the pitch and said, go on, try that again. It was absolutely glorious. Kind of similarities here, Jonathan, maybe, that Liverpool, you know, that they got over the line, but not much control, perhaps, again?
Yeah, I mean, we could easily this morning have been talking about City winning a 7-goal thriller and Liverpool being frustrated by drawing 3-3. And then the league table would look slightly different and we'd still be assuming this is City walking away with the title. So I think Liverpool got away with it. But the great thing I think you see us quite often with Liverpool is even when they're a bit flawed at the back, their capacity just to keep going and to physically overwhelm teams late in games, which they lost last season, that does seem to be back. And I think when they got to 3-3, you sort of expected them to get the winner then. I mean, they had, 4 minutes plus injury time to go, I think. And it came very quickly. But you sort of sensed that Fulham were out on their feet and and that they would get at least one more good opportunity. But yeah, I mean, four really great strikes from Liverpool, and they can't be relying on great strikes. You know, they will dry up at some point. But Salah seemed a bit off it yesterday, I thought, which, you know, he's been great this season, and he just wasn't quite there.
Well, Match of the Day, they said, yeah, he was off it. He's looking for his 200th goal, his 150th Premier League goal. Darwin Núñez was slightly off it, although Sporting at cracking plats.
How can you tell if Darwin Núñez is on it or off it?
what was he off? Did he just have a fairly unremarkable, competent game where nothing extraordinarily weird happened?
That's the measure of him, isn't it? Var's going to comment on his cracking plats. I mean, yeah. that was, I mean...
He strangely looked, Robin, like someone I used to play with, which is a little bit worrying.
Well, you know, Jill Scott used to say someone used to do her plats. I like to think of someone in the Liverpool dressing room doing them for him. Do you think, yeah. Who would that be?
It was Siobhan Chamberlain. Siobhan Chamberlain is the plat queen, so perhaps she went round and Nunez's house and did his.
Expertly done. But yeah, so yeah, it's hard on Fulham, wasn't it, Barney? And especially when, you know, Bobby Decord over Reed puts them ahead in the 80th minute and they come away with nothing. It's been a slightly strange season for them, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it has. They're really quite a good team, but they've had a few sort of players coming in and out, and they will be fine. But I think they've slightly kind of underachieved. It looks like they're in a bit more trouble than I think they realistically are. What I really enjoyed in this game was Trent Alexander-Arnold free kick. Just like the skill and the bravery and the vision and the everything required to do that, the years and years of practice, the precision, the ability to block out the moment. And it's an own goal. Yes, we just call that an own goal. It's a Bernd Leno own goal. Sorry, your name's not even... I mean, the footballs can be great sometimes. So in what sense is that an own goal?
If the goalkeeper wasn't there, would it have gone in?
Well, it was much more likely not to have gone in if Trent Alexander-Arnold wasn't there. If you had to take one person out of that equation to stop that happening, probably he would be more key to the moment. But it's to do with betting, isn't it? That's why it has to be an own goal.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm so naive.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Oh, right.
I mean, I have to say, on a Fulham point of view, I think Tom Kearney's made a difference in the last couple of games. I think he started against Wolves when Polinia was injured. He doesn't tend to play that much, but he came on a sub and made a difference for Fulham again. He doesn't sort of move as quickly as you would say the modern centre midfielder, but he's got a lot of game craft. And I do have, I'm a little biased because he was one of the kids at Leeds that got released for being too small at 16 with me shouting in the background, but he's still a child and he will grow. And he's now 6'2". And I don't like to say I was right, but I was right. But he's gone on to have a really good career and always makes a difference for Fulham. I mean, I think he's not like a bull in a china shop. Like, you know, is it Harrison Reed that plays, but Pline is, obviously, he's brilliant, but I think when he does come on, he made Deco Dover Reed's goal and got man of the match on Monday. And I think sometimes there's a place for he can't get around the pitch type centre midfielders, and certainly when they've got that sort of much game craft.
Still astounds me that so many football clubs don't remember that, you know, kids do tend to grow.
It is madness, but. You know, I think quite a lot. It just depends. I mean, also depends on what the first team manager or the first team ethos is, whatever, if they have got one. But, you know, if you've got somebody who can control and pass a ball better than anybody else in the group, but he's still a child and he's very small, then you sort of give him a little bit more time. Messi, for instance.
Yeah, that's the elite example, of course. Chelsea 3, Brighton 2. John Bruin saying, why does every Brighton game seem to end in a ruck? And I think that's just the vibe for Roberto De Zerbi. He just loves it. You know, a lot of a bit of pushing, shoving after the full-time whistle, Pochettino having a go at the officials. And this seems to be a theme once again. Chelsea getting over the line, Barney, and another player sent off. Do they have a discipline problem, do we think, maybe?
I think they have many problems. Is it discipline? I mean, there are so many players revolving in and out of the team, and it's such an ill-fitting assort. It's this sort of new idea of how to build a team which isn't building a team at all. It's not surprising things get lost. I thought the Conor Gallagher's tackle on Billy Gilmore was actually quite I mean, in slow motion, it looked quite vicious. I don't know if it was a kind of old teammates thing or I'll show you.
I don't know. He seems like a sort of, he's quite an aggressive player, isn't he, Gallagher?
Yeah, yeah, he does get stuck in. But it kind of went that little bit beyond, I'm going to take the ball into kind of, and while I do it, I'm going to knock you over. Chelsea seem to win a lot of games, but still seem to be, you know, closer to the relegation zone than the... They're just such a confusing team and such a confusing entity. I can't see, it's really hard to see any kind of happy ending in that group of players or what they're sort of trying to do. It seems to change all the time. And I don't really understand how they won that game, but somehow they did just by throwing lots of players who can do spectacular things at a game of football. I don't like it at all. I find it completely incoherent. It's like a child playing football on a computer game, and I find it really boring, actually. And I wonder if Pochettino can make it interesting, because I always thought he was a manager who was interested in chemistry and the way players work with each other. It just seems a very odd fit, but who knows? Give him 10 years, maybe.
It is similar, though, Banner, to a child playing a computer game, because it seems to be an owner playing a computer game, you know, an owner that thinks that it's easy to, oh, I can do that, what a manager does, but, you know, the technical area is a lonely place, and you'll see that managers stood in the technical area and having to make decisions. It's all right sort of picking them out on paper, but obviously having to do it, I feel a little bit for Pochettino, but trying to turn a oil tanker around, it's in with a load of different players, and that's it, too many players, but then too many injuries, so that you can't get anything sort of with any sort of certainty or consistency.
It's just so that they bought these players clearly as a kind of investment vehicle. We'll buy all the young talent. But football is not, it's not, there's no draft in football. You don't know who the best players are. The market is vast. There are billions of kids all around the world who nobody knows if they're going to be any good or not. You cannot corner the market. All you can do is give people a chance and hope they get better and try and construct a team. And the idea that you're going to buy up all the good players, I'm going to buy Mudrik because he's on YouTube and he looks good on YouTube. It's just so stupid. I mean, it's absolutely dunderheaded. And I don't think anything this incompetent has ever happened in sport. If you put the money and the results so far, I mean, maybe it'll all turn around and it will turn out to be a master plan and they can disrupt football by having thought about it for 10 minutes. I mean, I'm all for people disrupting things, but it has to be done intelligently and with some inside knowledge, not just because you think you understand how business works, which seems to be what's happened here. So, yeah, good old Chelsea.
Just thinking about who we could sign next on YouTube, it might be Joe Wicks popping out for Chelsea, especially if it, yeah. P with Joe over lockdown.
I'm not a betting woman, but I don't think Joe Wicks can kick a ball straight properly. That's just really? My, yeah.
I think he did soccer, yeah. Did he? Did he do something like
oh,
that?
Oh, did he? Oh, right, okay.
But that still doesn't mean he can kick a ball straight.
Is Joe Wicks the fitness bloke from Essex?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, but he could come in as like a fitness coach. I mean, Pochettino's
yeah, that's
fitness.
Actually a really good idea. And if you suggested that, they would definitely do it.
Yeah, they would.
They should sign I Show Speed because he's showed speed. I mean, they would literally, it doesn't seem to be in. Why not? You know, do it. It makes as much sense as anything else.
Well, Enzo Fernandez got two goals, one a penalty, and Levi Colwill got the other one. And a very funny moment where he scored and celebrated for about 3 seconds, then realised who he'd scored against the team that sort of made him last season and then sort of called for calm. Jonathan, Brighton are sort of, they scored a good goal, Buonanotte, and then João Pedro got one right at the end to kind of make it a bit interesting. They've got glimpses of Brighton, haven't they? But they're not getting there sort of for 90 minutes and for this season actually generally. Is that just down to perhaps the increased schedule?
Yeah, probably. I mean, we've seen it before with teams who've had a really good season, then year takes out of them. I mean, they've got a lot of injuries. I know everybody's got a lot of injuries at the minute. It sort of feels like you say it for every team. Dunk obviously is suspended, which is his own fault. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything to worry about. I think there's, to an extent, a natural regression to the mean, but it must take it out of you, especially if you're Brighton, you're not used to that in any sense. And for fans as well, if you're beating Ajax and Marseille midweek to then... Yeah, try and raise yourself for a run-of-the-mill league game. I know it's Chelsea, so it feels a bit more glamorous, but essentially a mid-table league game, of course there's a drop-off because it's beating Marseille and Ajax that are the exciting things.
So Brighton are struggling to raise any interest in playing Chelsea these days.
Well, so I also, if you're thinking about,
I think you're projecting your own feelings of,
I mean, jaded, I really
disaffection onto this group of young, really enthusiastic, up and coming, super talented footballers. Yeah, Julio Enciso, he's just like me. He doesn't want to see Brighton against Chelsea happen.
I was like Julio Enciso when I was 19. I had the similar haircut, similar aggression.
Yeah. Actually, he's injured, isn't he? He's a really big miss.
He is injured, yeah. I mean, I have to say, I really did struggle to raise myself for West Ham v Palace yesterday. struggled to raise myself to get on the train to go. Struggled to raise myself to write a piece. Struggled to raise myself even to watch the second half. It was dreadful. But
more on that later. Look forward to that, everyone. just one final note on this one. So, yes, Conor Gallagher was sent off. In the previous game, Reece James was sent off wearing the captain's armband. So let's see who's going to be next.
Well, Cassano could have gone as well, couldn't he? I mean, he was already on a yellow and that challenge. I mean, it could have been a booking.
That's what I'm saying. They've got a bit of a discipline problem. 47 cards, 3 red this season, the highest in the league. But that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll discuss the first sacking of the season. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Burnley 5, Sheffield United 0. And that was the final straw for Paul Heckingbottom. The 4th of December, we've had our first Premier League sacking. Just on the game, first of all, I mean, Burnley flew out of the traps. Jay Rodriguez scoring after 15 seconds. And Jamie says, can we have praise for Jay Rodriguez, please? Still getting the goals after playing for either Burnley or Southampton since the mid-90s, it seems. They really went about this, didn't they, Lucy? And Burnley is their first home win of the season. It's been a miserable time and a huge, huge win and confidence boost.
Yeah, I mean, Jay Rodriguez makes me laugh. You think you're just going to get this accent that's going to be sort of very sort of foreign and remarkable, and he's got a Burnley. It's just the best. I love it when they ask you a question and they go, oh, Jay Rodriguez, and then he just talks like that. It's so northern. I just love it. But yeah, at Burnley, you know, I like Vincent Kompany, but I think that you have to get used to losing more than you win. And the teams that get used to losing more than they win when they're used to winning more than they lose are the ones that adapt quick. And as soon as you get that, as soon as that, the penny drops with promoted teams about that, that you cannot let anything affect you. So if you lose 3 in a row, you can't let it affect you. And that's so difficult. And I think that's the biggest issue for a manager. So we're talking Sheffield United, Burnley and Luton. The ones who get used to that quickly will be the ones that sort of flourish and maybe get some of those results when they're sort of focusing on a game at a time. But yeah, I think Burnley did brilliant. And I think that that's sort of a monkey off the back. But, you know, Sheffield United, they had absolutely no chance when they got, they sort of overachieved when they were promoted. And then he wasn't backed in the summer. They sold the two best players a week before the start of the season. Absolutely no chance. Hecking bottom. I don't know what people expect. However, you know, when the spotlight's on you, you've got to sort of show that you're having an effect. And I think, you know, lost a little bit. Although I think McBurney's second yellow card was a little bit, I'm not sure that was a yellow card when I watched it. But obviously, having done the first one, then, you know, you can't do that again. Probably can't put your arms out again. But a little bit of indiscipline. And the players don't look quite like they are producing for the manager. And I think as soon as that shown, then you know, Heckingbottom had no chance.
McBurney went full Duncan Ferguson with those two elbows, so yeah, not helped, and that probably helped rack up the scoreline. Where does Sheffield United, though, Jonathan, go from here? Because Lucy just raised it. I mean, I doubt it's going to be a rescue job, is it? With the greatest of respect, it's nearly impossible, isn't it, at this stage for Sheffield United to get out of this? It's going to take something pretty momentous.
Yeah, it would do. I mean, if in terms of the nature of their squad, in terms of how they've played so far, I think you'd say that it's not impossible in terms of points because of the Everton points deduction. It's not that they're cast adrift. It looks like 3 from 4. So from that point of view, you're not looking really at the gap. You're looking at, can we catch Luton? Can we keep in range of Everton?
You just have to run faster than Luton and you'll stay up.
Well, and Everton. Everton carrying their 10 points of burden.
Is there much evidence they can do that?
I mean, I think before the last two games, they've been all right, haven't they? They got 4 points from two games before the last two, but they've just looked dreadful the last two games. But it just sort of feels in football sometimes oh, this isn't working. We're going to have to do something. What's the thing that teams do? They sack the manager. And I just sort of think, I mean, you know, we talked about this before the pod, weren't we? And sort of saying managers will always take jobs because there's not many jobs about. But it's sort of a hiding to nothing. You're probably just going to get a relegation on your CV. And it's so early in the season that it will.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Impact your capacity to turn things around next season. So we've seen it with, you know, Jan Sievert or Dean Smith. Chris Wilder's the obvious one because he's floating about, obviously has recent-ish history with the club. So maybe he goes back there. But I feel sorry for Paul Heckingbottom. I just don't. His mistake was to get him promoted. That was what he should never have done.
Yeah, but although that will remain on his on his CV, and hopefully he'll get a job with someone who wants to be promoted. I mean, he literally has. I mean, the he's got the word bottom in his name, and you know, I don't know if the nominative determinism, but it is very much a kind of switch it off, turn it off and on again sacking, isn't it? Let's see if this does something. We've run out of ideas, but they should hire a 27-year-old German who skateboards and wears purple trousers and has ideas. And I mean, it's for kind of a free hit, isn't it? But having said that, they're only 4 points away from being out of the relegation zone. It's not the end of the world, but yeah.
It is annoying. It's one of my bugbears at the moment that football becomes obsessed with certain things, and it's become obsessed with coaches that have never played and have just coached, and they're the best thing since sliced bread. I think it's every single managerial appointment in the last sort of few weeks has been somebody who is a young coach who probably still old enough to play. So then you say, well, how come you're not still playing? And I don't know. There's a balance with everything, but they I call them iPad coaches. And, you know, when it gets right down to the real sort of dirt stuff of football, I'm not sure an iPod coach has that ability to sort of, and I know it's a controversial opinion, but, you know, at halftime, if you've never been in that sort of situation, you have to sort of, you have to have had that, or it helps if you've had that experience. The balance of the two is wonderful.
Who are you thinking of here? Are we talking Joe Edwards? Who are these iPad coaches?
The younger ones who keep getting opportunities when they fail at some clubs. They just, and I'm not talking about the older ones anymore. There's certain managers that don't do that well at clubs and then just get another club just because they're young and they actually talk. The key is, Barney, is talking a good game. So owners go, wow, he knows what he's doing. But look at his win percentage at wherever he's just been, and he's...
Hasn't this always happened in football, though? And this is just a different little... I mean, you had the round of guys who just got jobs, you know. I mean, people will say Steve Bruce, but I'm not saying Steve Bruce. You know, Mark Hughes. You just appoint one of those guys because they're a famous...
Yeah, probably.
Isn't that just from the other end?
No, it's just a younger, more snazzy merry-go-round on skateboards, is what we're saying. Barney, Vincent Kompany, it's big win for him. And I think Burnley really, really, really didn't want to, you know, have to pull the trigger on him. I'm not sure if they would have done, actually, because you think he'd probably be the best person to bring them back up. But I really like him.
Yeah, I don't think they would. I mean, he's built so much there sort of to his design. I think sacking him would be a massive thing. You're going to have to change everything. And I think it's interesting what Lucy was saying probably applies to Burnley. I think you were talking about Burnley. The idea that you've got to learn to lose games. That's what Nottingham Forest were really good at last year. You got the thing, every game was a separate event and they would just walk out and run around and didn't matter what happened before. And if you're playing you've got this kind of idea of a process and this is how we play. If you lose three games in a row, you probably do start to doubt yourself. I quite like Vincent Kompany, although he does kind of... So you're going to become mayor of Manchester at one point. He kind of talks as though he already is the mayor of Manchester. He's kind of got... But he's very likeable, and I want him to be good. I want to believe in him. And some of the players they've got there are great to watch. You know, and I'm sure that they'll be fine. I think if they realise they've got good enough players to win enough games and look at it from that way, we're going to win enough games if we just keep playing like this, then they'll be fine, and they'll probably get better next year.
To St James's Park then, Newcastle 1, Manchester United 0. Ryan says, with Newcastle putting out the same team against United as against PSG in the week and only having about 7 fit players to their name, who's more tired, them or Croatia? It's never Croatia. Is it generally remarkable, or are United just that bad? So Anthony Gordon with the only goal of the game. But Jonathan, it was a 1-0 battering, wasn't it?
Oh, it really was, yeah. And if that late Harry Maguire goal had counted, I mean, it was obviously offside, shouldn't have counted, but had that counted, it would have been a scandal. But United is in that position now where, I mean, I think they've done well enough recently against teams they should be beating, that Ten Hag is safe at least until the Jim Ratcliffe semi-takeover thing happens, and then I think decisions will be made. So at least are not in that position where they might have to get rid of him because football clubs just sack the manager because they don't have anything else to do, and then bring in an interim. But yeah, the fact that they're being investigated over not cooking their chicken properly, the fact that their flight was cancelled and they had to get the bus, you know, nothing is going right for them. And partly, you know, partly it is a lack of investment in infrastructure. Things go wrong. I mean, I'm guessing if you pay your chefs the right amount, they can tell if a chicken's bleeding or if it's kind of cooked.
There is systemic mediocrity all the way through. Are you employing people who are the best at what they do, or people who are simply going to agree with you? And that goes all the way down from the top.
And Lucy, I think it's important, as you pointed out, the contrast between Manchester United and Newcastle. They both had energy sapping, emotionally draining games in midweek, and it couldn't have been more different between the way they went about this game.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about Eddie Howe and what he's managed to establish at Newcastle. You know, I know we talk about the money and, you know, and the players, but, you know, that top team spirit, that energy, that, you know, the way that they played, is regardless of who plays. Obviously, they've got a young player came in, did really well. But, you know, I just think that's the foundation. You can always fall back on that. And if you haven't got that and you try and fall back on it, then you know, you come up short. And I think Alan Shearer said it on Match of the Day that things start to go wrong. They don't roll the sleeves up. And when you've got a captain like Bruno Fernandes, who is an unbelievable player, but I think that his first thought when things go wrong is to moan and to you know, to throw his arms in the air. I think that is sort of epitomises the rest of the group. I think Marcus Rashford, his body language was quite interesting. His sort of lack of immediate, you know, reaction to sort of track back, and that, you know, that's not him, is it? So what else, you know, what else is going on there where he, you know, he has that sort of or seemingly that sort of attitude? And that, you know, I just think that's it. They don't want to, when things are going right, they're fine. When things are going wrong, I don't think they've got the sort of ability to, or enough of ability to roll the sleeves up.
I think that's been true all season. It's I think his attitude generally this season's been odd. So you think of the England-Italy game even. So even when he's outside the United, you know, environment. And I watched that game in Romania, so I had Romanian commentary on. So I wasn't being sort of led by the commentator. And that Italy goal, the tendency looking on Twitter seemed to be to blame Maguire. And then some people said, oh, actually, I think it's Stones. No, it was Rashford. Rashford doesn't track back. So Italy get a 2-1 on their right. And that's why the cross comes in.
Yeah, I mean, I think having worked with young players a lot, my first thought of looking at him is, right, what's going on? Who's looking after him welfare-wise? And I know that they've got a really sort of strong academy sort of welfare education at Manchester United. I've worked quite a lot with them over the years, but there is something there, whatever it is, whether it's to do with sort of work or whether it's to do with personal life. But, you know, you sort of have to sort of question that, and you know, my first thought would be sort of support. But yeah, it's not quite all there, is it? I think that's an understatement.
Well, Newcastle might be without Nick Pope as well for some time. Eddie Howe saying that he might have dislocated his shoulder, so he's going to see a specialist today. That'll do for part two. Next, we'll look at the rest of the Premier League. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Arsenal 2, Wolves 1. So Arsenal top of the Premier League. Perhaps a bit more comprehensive than the scoreline suggests. Arsenal, Jonathan, it seems finding their rhythm. They've had a couple of really good performances. But I saw before this, Tim Stillman of this parish was saying that they're getting the job done without being that much fun. They seem to be a bit more fun now. But is this perhaps better way of going about trying to win a title?
I think defensively they're a lot more reliable than they were last season. I think the squad's deeper. They haven't been as fluent, and that may be partly because Arteta's been fiddling about a bit with getting fullbacks moving in the midfield. I also think teams have worked out if you want to stop them, you've got to double up on Saka and Martinelli. And the teams who've done that successfully, so you think of when they lost at Newcastle, for instance, Saka and Martinelli really struggled to get involved in that game. So I think there is now a formula to beat them, and Arsenal have to find other ways of scoring goals. But I didn't think Wolves did shut down Saka and Martinelli particularly, if you think of that first goal. And I think, I can't remember if it was Gary O'Neill or one of the Wolves players said they'd worked all week on how to stop Saka, and then within 15 minutes, however long it was, he scored and they haven't done what they'd worked on.
Yeah, very good team goals from Arsenal in this one. Eddie Nketiah also hitting the post. Mateus Cunha getting one back for Wolves. Some positives there, Barney, perhaps that Gary O'Neill won't have to receive an apology from the PGMOL this weekend.
Yeah, and Gary O'Neill and his... It's like he's getting divorced from VAR and they have to have these constant, painful discussions. So we had a really, really long discussion, and I really feel like saying someone needs to just give him a hug and say, it's just a game, Gary. It's just a game. It's a game. You're propelling an inflated sphere into a netted square. And that's all it is. We don't need to have any more long talks. Let's try and have some fun. Let's rediscover the joy, Gary.
What does VAR get and what does Gary O'Neill get? Is this the negotiation in the divorce? Does he get... Do they keep the screen and...
I think they get Anthony, VAR gets Anthony Taylor and Darren England, and Gary gets a whole load of bad decisions.
It's like a fair split. Nottingham Forest 0, Everton 1. Lucy, was this the defiant performance from Everton that we were expecting last weekend against the corrupt Premier League, of course?
Yeah, interesting, Everton. I think that Dyche seems to have got them going this season. Obviously, that's a hammer blow. But I think that, you know, everybody's saying they'll be all right. I just think that this sort of performance is they know, if we're talking about getting used to sort of losing more than you win, I think that Everton have that sort of attitude. They know where the games to target, that they'll know that they can get 3 points from. Forest is quite interesting because Cooper obviously seems to be under pressure, and I did notice that Joe Worrall, club captain, has not been involved in the last couple of squads after sort of being in and out of the team. He's not injured. And it's amazing how, I mean, I'm not saying anything's gone on, but it's amazing how that might affect stability in a club. And then what I'm talking about is if he's sort of been frozen out, if he's not been chosen for squads, then it affects the rest of the players because he's club captain. He's obviously a very influential player. He's been there a while, and be interested to see whether that has had some effect on the group of players. Because like Barney said before, players are human. They react to different things happening to people that they like within a club. And just him not being around and not being part of the squad is quite, and them not really getting the results has been quite interesting.
Do we think we might see the end of Steve Cooper? Jonathan, as Lois has said, he seems to be perennially under pressure.
Yeah, I mean, Marinakis clearly is a... He's not an owner who's afraid to sack people, but equally, Cooper's very, very popular with the fans, and I think he's done a really good job. So it would be a risk for them to get rid of him, particularly at the minute, given I don't think Forest really are in any serious danger of being relegated. I think they would possibly have been slightly unlucky in the last couple of weeks with a couple of penalty decisions. The home form was what kept them up last season, and they start to drop points at home. That would be the concern, because I don't think their away form is particularly... It probably is a bit better than last season. It hasn't picked up dramatically. But I don't think there's any real reason to get too worked up yet.
Forest could have had a penalty to Koure on Yates. That was discussed quite length on Sky. Everton have not lost under Sean Dyche when they've scored the first goal, and 33 of his 82 Premier League wins, Sean Dyche, have been by 1-0, which I think might be the most Sean Dyche stat I've ever seen. Brentford 3, Luton 1. I think, Barney, this possibly just shows that, you know, Brentford, they've got up to the Premier League seamlessly, and they might be the next sort of Palace, that purgatory team where people start to think, oh, where are we going next?
Yeah, I really like Brentford. I think they're great. They kind of create chaos, don't they? They create this really physical sort of pressure. It must be horrible to play against them. It's a funny little ground surrounded by tower blocks. It's not exactly a cauldron. it's more like a really good, like a cage in the middle of a nice new estate. But they Thomas Frank knows exactly what he's doing, and they really play on their opponents' weaknesses. I think they're great to watch. And I just couldn't see any universe in which Luton were going to beat them, because they're so pragmatic, and it's exactly the kind of team that will find your weak spots.
Mm. Neil Mopay, second goal in 9 for Brentford. Who needs Ivan Toney? I think
Arsenal.
do you think Chelsea? That's yeah, possibly one of them. But it's been impressive, hasn't it, Lucy? They've absorbed his absence so well, Brentford. I mean, Thomas Frank, I'm a huge fan of his and his wonderful hair.
Yeah,
he just knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
Yeah, and it's a good club as well, and they've responded over the years to losing their best players, and then, you know, the rest of the players stepping up, and you know, obviously, and Bermo, he's scoring goals, and he's probably been in the shadow of Toney sort of the last couple of seasons, so he's stepped up. Thomas Frank is a tactician, and I think that he obviously gets them going. I did that Chelsea Brentford game, and even though he said they didn't play well in the first half, they defended well, and that's all they probably needed to do at that stage, because then they got goal in the second half. But it's a good club because they've got a strategy, and again, it's, you know, quite a few clubs find it very, very difficult for a cohesive, coherent strategy. But I think Brentford have certainly got that off, obviously based on data. And I think they've now started to develop, because obviously the Premier League rules now say that you've got to have at least a Cat 3 academy by next season. So they've had to bring their academy back bit by bit. I think they started a Cat 4, trying to move to Cat 1. They didn't see the point in it before because, you know, the best players would just be taken for no money, hardly any money, by, you know, the big clubs around in the London area. So they just used to make friends with the London clubs and go, right, we'll have a sell-on clause. We'll take the ones you've released at whatever age group, near a sort of 16, 17, 18. We'll try and turn them into players, and then you can have a percentage of the sell-on. And it worked for them. So now they've just a little bit of a different strategy now.
West Ham 1, Crystal Palace 1. Jonathan, you did manage to get there and watch a game of football and write a piece afterwards. We should congratulate you
I'm
on that.
I'm not sure I watched a game of football.
watched something.
It was pretty grim. I mean, even David Moyes afterwards was sort of like, oh yeah, we couldn't really raise it. We didn't have a personality to get going. We couldn't get the atmosphere going. It was just so drab. And Amakudas played well. Again, he's obviously a really good player. It was a nice goal, actually. I mean, I know it was deflected, but the move leading up to it was nice. Palace were dangerous from set plays. That was the only real opportunity they created. Even the goal came from a goal kick, albeit West Ham goal kick. And you sort of thought everybody would be much happier if sort of your 1 o'clock, David Moyes and Roy Hodgson just wandered out, shaking hands. We're calling it the draw, lads. We're going home. We're going to go and watch some Matlock DVDs together, and off you go. You can go, you know, there's loads of football on telly today, probably better than this. Just go and watch that. It wasn't great. But I guess from Palace's point of view, that, you know, they're without a win in 6 now, but they've at least now got an extra point. They'd lost 4 of the previous 5, so getting the draw, I guess, a point that West Ham's a good result. It just eases, if there was any pressure there, it just eases that. Because they do have, I think it's Bournemouth midweek and then Liverpool and City. So if they were to lose that Bournemouth game, maybe pressure could come fairly quickly.
Mm. Happy Monday, West Ham and Crystal Palace fans. Bournemouth 2, Aston Villa 2. Bournemouth played very well and were slightly unlucky not to win this one. And Barney Ollie Watkins showing his elite with a fantastic header. He will be the one that Gareth Southgate throws on when England are desperate to get a goal back in the Euros this summer, do we think?
I don't know if he's a sort of game-changey type player. I mean, he is he's really come on, hasn't he? His movement, and you know, you could set up a whole team around the way he plays because he's so good at running in behind. But that finish was incredible, wasn't it? That's like a dream goal, like the neck muscles, the kind of directing the ball, putting power. It's a sort of goal you'd score in your sleep, isn't it? And kind of you watch it, a power header rippling the net. That's the goal I'd like to score. If I could just come on and, you know, maybe play for Man City for half an hour or something, I could probably muster one of those up. But he's got to be in the England squad because he's a really good player now, really good player. But I don't know if he's an impact sub exactly. Would you bring him on as an impact person? He's someone who you'd want to base a system around. No, I suspect Harry Kane might start. He's looking decent. England are weird though, aren't they? I mean, if you look at it, England actually good now. I've spent years saying, nah, England have the greatest hand of young players in Europe. No, they don't. But they actually do now. Bellingham is a real game changer there. I was thinking about that this weekend. Best player in La Liga at the moment. Best player in the Bundesliga. They're all English. Is the best player in the Premier League English? Probably not. But it's worrying times for Gareth.
Very disconcerting, isn't it? Dominic Solanke with a really nicely taken goal as well. And Antoine Semenyo had a really good game, Jonathan. I think we'll probably cover this a little bit more in the new year, but he's one that I know Bournemouth fans are quite worried about losing to AFCON, and that's going to be something that the Premier League is going to... I mean, most clubs, I guess, in the Premier League are going to have to address.
No, I mean, I think he's really good. It can go either way. He's good with both feet. I think he could have been sent off yesterday, actually. I mean, he was on a yellow and a very obvious shirt pull. But yeah, he's... I was at that game when they beat Newcastle, and he looked outstanding that game. He's sort of, I don't know, he's not just technically good, he's big with it. Whereas you look at something like Justin Clive, it just seems a little bit lightweight still. So yeah, he's a really good player, and he will be a loss come January.
The draw for the Euro 2024 group stages took place on Saturday. Scotland will be opening the tournament. They face off with host nation Germany. They've also got Hungary and Switzerland in their group. England in Group C, Slovenia, Denmark and Serbia. Group B, we think, is the group of death: Spain, Croatia, Italy, and Albania. Also to note, Wales are in path A of the playoffs, meaning that if they can get past Finland and then either Poland or Estonia, they will end up in Group D with France, Netherlands and Austria. Quick round of what else happened over the weekend. FA Cup second round. Charlie says, can anyone stop Gillingham on their march to the FA Cup? They've knocked out Charlton, Oxford and Cambridge both through. So that's good for your interim host and your permanent host. Yeah, Jim says, what routes will Oxford's open top bus take when they show off the FA Cup at the end of the season? I think they take promotion first. Shocks, a few of them. Maidstone United of National League, led by George Ellacobe, beat League Two Barrow. Chesterfield beating Leyton Orient. The biggest upset, although I wouldn't put this down as a surprise, Eastleigh's 2-1 win over Reading. The big picks possibly from the draw: Arsenal against Liverpool and Wilson, Sunderland against Newcastle. Trying to get to that one, do you think?
I will avoid it at all costs. It just sounds awful. We've got a great record against them recently. It's a shame that it's going to be jeopardised. What I will say is that Sunderland have not lost to Newcastle in the FA Cup for over 100 years. Bill Holden getting both goals when Sunderland won 2-0 in the quarterfinal at St James in 1956. And then Sunderland won in a third replay in 1913 on the way to the final, where controversially beaten by Villa in the final, so controversially that Sunderland refused to turn up for the Charity Shield next year because they were so...
You have to interrupt him or it will just keep going. Can we talk about NFTs or Snapchat or Super Leagues or something modern just to clear the palate of all that?
No, definitely. Okay, this will clear the palate. Women's Nations League, very exciting. England coming from 2-0 down to win 3-2 at Wembley against the Netherlands on Friday night. Very flat though after a full-time whistle, because qualification to the final and then to the Olympics is now out of their hands. They need to beat Scotland at Hampden Park on Tuesday night, and they also need Netherlands to drop points against Belgium, or they manage a 3-goal swing in their favour. Well, much more on that and the plans for the new Champions League format in the women's game on the Guardian Women's Football Weekly, which will be out tomorrow. Don't really have time for any other business. A lot of people asking about my Munich moment, and we've run out of time. Maybe next time. So I think we'll leave it there. Unless anyone else wants to share their Munich moment, this is a safe space. I'm guessing no. We've been here long enough.
What's a Munich moment?
Barry's Munich moment.
Shot himself on the U-Bahn.
Ah, that sounds like oversharing.
Okay.
And I'm glad we have the new regime in place now.
Well, thank you very much, comrades. Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Cheers, Rob.
And to you, Barney. Thank you very much.
Cheers, everyone.
We'll be back on Thursday to cover some of the midweek games. Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray, and our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.